Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello, everyone. I am Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We have a really good show lined up for you today. Unfortunately, our guest will only be here for the second hour, but he's going to be here there, and our guest today will be Ben Witherington III. Oh my gosh, I'm just so excited about this podcast, Ben. I really try and get you the best, and I hope I've done this time, and he's going to be here to talk about the Christmas narratives. And Ben Witherington is, as far as I'm concerned, a scholar, So, before I go on and talk about him, we are going to be talking, of course, about Christmas. Now, around here, Christmas is celebrated strongly. My family has always loved the Christmas season. I mean, as far as I know, they start playing Christmas music in July. I mean, at least the first song is played on July 25th. And the Christmas tree is usually put up on Thanksgiving Day. And we've tried to keep things the same here in my household now, between I and myself, and we both really, really like Christmas and the exchange of gifts with one another and such. We've got our tree up decorated already. We've taken a few pictures of our cat underneath it. And we've got some garlands hung up. We've got a wreath around our door. And, of course, I made it absolutely imperative we have to hang up mistletoe somewhere. After all, I have priorities, you know. And so we got some mistletoe hanging up in the living room. Everything. The only thing we really can't provide is we are hoping we get to have a white Christmas. And here in Tennessee, East Tennessee, that's not unheard of. It's happened before. We do understand while we were out for Thanksgiving, we did miss a snow that came in, which is rather unfortunate. But what can I say? I love Christmas time. And that's why also I'm thankful that one of our recent guests just released a book about Christmas. I'm talking about J.P. Holding, who was on here on November 23rd. And he's released a book recently you can get on your Kindle on Amazon. It's called Christmas is Pagan and Other Myths. Now, this is a short one for you all to read, okay? Because I started reading it last night. I finished it just a little while ago, and I was just reading it every now and then. And such. You can probably finish it in a couple hours or so. And it's packed with some really good information. And we're going to be looking at this a little bit more a couple weeks from now. I do have a guest coming on who's going to discuss Christmas traditions and such. And I hope it'll be a really interesting show. But I've already been encountering people who are arguing against Christmas. These people show up constantly. It seems like there's this great mission the church has that, we must avoid anything that could be pagan. Yeah. Now, there are some great, great dangers here, other than we're missing out on Christmas. That's a minor one compared to some of the other dangers. I mean, if someone really does have a problem with Christmas and really is convinced in their own minds they shouldn't separate, well, okay, you know, I think it's a bit weird, but okay. But at the same time, when you're giving reasons why I should have the same mindset, you better make sure those are darn good reasons. And so far, I'm not seeing any of those reasons. Now, the great danger here is that, first off, Christians will be shown to be not able to do good history. Because we're going to accept myths uncritically that we get from people. One such example is using a book called The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. Hislop was a terrible researcher. His work is not to be taken seriously at all. Personally, I think he just makes up some stuff even. But yet, he's accepted. And people will just accept someone because, well, they wrote a book, so sure it has to be true. Without doing any real research themselves into the subject matter. And I know about this because I read a lot of books that I disagree with. And it's only by having done real research in the subject matter that I can know what I'm talking about with these kinds of things. But when Christians accept claims uncritically, it really puts us in a dangerous position. And this gets us into the ever great terror here, and that's that we will unsuspectingly fall prey to the copycat hypothesis. Now, what's the idea of that? That's the idea that Jesus is a copycat of pagan mythologies and such. You know, figures like Mithras, and Dionysus, and Horus, and Attis, and Zalmoxis, and all these others. Yeah, we've heard them over and over again. Okay? The sad thing is, many Christians are flummoxed immediately when they hear these claims. They don't know what to do. Wait, this Mithras guy was born of a virgin and had 12 disciples? Well, first off, something like that, it's bogus. Well, maybe not the virgin part entirely. I mean, Mithras was born out of a rock. And I suppose you could say the rock was a virgin. You know, kind of like the chair I'm sitting in is a virgin right now. And this headset I'm using is a virgin. So yeah, I guess we could go with that one. And then we can look at the 12 disciples. Those are most likely 12 signs of a zodiac. See, the problem is we don't have any Mithraic writings. Sorry. We don't. We have to go by artwork and references from other people to figure out what the followers of Mithraism believe. And that's not an easy task whatsoever. And to claim this great knowledge that some have, it's really going towards the wrong end. But unfortunately, if you buy into the idea that Christmas comes from the pagans, you are setting yourself up to believe everything was copied from the pagans, including Christianity itself. And, in fact, ultimately, unless you do the historical research on your own, you're going to be picking and choosing what you believe comes from the pagans and what you don't, based largely on your own personal preferences. You know, another great danger I see with all this, it's just this whole idea that we're running from anything that could possibly have a pagan influence. See, I've been told, for instance, that wedding rings have a pagan influence. And honestly, I haven't looked into this because, frankly, I don't care. I wear my wedding ring every day. For about 3 years, I have never taken it off. I used to take it off when I was getting a shower or something like that, but I just found, you know, it's really difficult for me to do this over and over. I'll just leave it on. So I've been wearing my wedding ring consistently for several years now. Now, my wedding ring is the Martin Luther wedding ring. My wife picked it out for me. You know, when we were meeting the pastor of his church we were attending, he took notice of it pretty quickly, not surprisingly. It's a Lutheran church. And what I told him is what I've told so many other people when I've said it's a Martin Luther wedding ring, is that when I was giving my wedding vows, I was tempted to say, "Here I stand, I can do no other, unless I am convinced by scripture or pure reason." But let's suppose you came and gave me proof that I could not deny that the wedding rings were pagan in origin. You know what I'm going to say? Very simple. I don't care. What, you don't care? It's pagan in origin. Yeah, I don't care. Well, why wouldn't you care? Well, because one thing, I still refer to this day of the week as Saturday. That day comes from pagan origins. My parents who live next door drive these cars called Saturns, and you know the names of the planets. They come from pagan gods. The months of the calendar, in many cases, come from pagans. Do we worship those pagan gods anymore? Not a bit. You know why I wear my wedding ring? I wear it as a symbol of my devotion and love to my wife. My commitment to her that says, "We are married till death do us part." I don't wear this thing to honor any pagan whatsoever. You know, I'd say it's the same with Christmas. I won't set up a Christmas tree to honor a pagan deity. I don't worship on December 25th to honor a pagan deity. Why do I do all these things? To celebrate Christ. Personally, I believe in the Christ who's gone out to conquer and redeem the world. You know that charge we were given in Genesis 1 to bring the world into subjugation and such? Yeah, I think that still applies. Except now we're supposed to bring it subject to Christ. And that means every single day of a year is subject to Jesus. That includes December 25th. And if that is the day that we have chosen to celebrate the fact that the incarnation took place, then that is the day we will celebrate. And if you have a problem with that, well, I guess you're going to have a problem. Okay? But my family will not change the worship of Christ on Christmas just so you'll feel better about things for yourself. If you don't want to celebrate Christmas, well, you know, that's a little bit bizarre and such, but okay, dude, whatever floats your boat. As long as you love Christ and you're honoring him, go ahead. But don't tell me I'm not honoring Christ by celebrating Christmas. So that's why I'm thankful that there's a book out there called Christmas is Pagan and Other Myths to deal with these kinds of conspiracy theories. And my thinking always with these conspiracy theories is at the very start, I don't give them credibility. Conspiracies happen, yes, but they are very, very, very difficult to pull off. And the grander they are, the less likely I am to believe them. It's also one reason I find it hard to believe that Christianity is any kind of conspiracy whatsoever, as if the disciples would get together and plan out something like this. No, no, they wouldn't. Nothing to gain on their part. Said this several times before. In their culture, they would have, in fact, been risking everything. So, people, please, feel free to celebrate Christmas. That's why I'm going to be trying to focus as much as I can this month on Christmas. Now, I tell you, I'm still working on getting a good guest for next week. I got some of mine. There were some potential openings. I wanted to keep them open just in case, but ultimately the spots didn't get filled, unfortunately. So I'm waiting to see if I can get someone in for next week. And I'd like you all to know, if you have any suggestions for a guest you'd like to see on the show, let me know. Doesn't mean I'll agree, doesn't mean I'll go with it, but, you know, I'm interested in hearing who you are want to hear. And I've even heard some people say, we'd like to see some debates take place on the show. Maybe I could arrange some with a Christian or non-Christian sometime, sort of like what's done on Unbelievable. If you'd like to see that, let me know, because the only way I can know what you think about the show is if you tell me what you think. But for this week, we're talking about Christmas and how much it changes everything. And indeed it does. You know, sometimes in Christian circles, we get so caught up on issues like the age of the earth in Genesis. Now, that's an important question. Okay, I'm not going to deny it. But it's not a central question. If you're someone who's a young earth creationist, for instance, there's no place to tell your old earth brothers and sisters that they're heretics, for taking scripture less seriously than you do, etc. And most, you know, my persuasion, I side with John Walton on this one. But I'm happily married to a young earth creationist. And I don't have any problems with that whatsoever. There are a number of Christians I know and respect in the field who are young earth creationists. I don't have a problem. So why am I talking about the age of the earth right now? Because our gospel doesn't really focus on the question of the age of the earth. And if you marry your Christianity to that question, you're going to have some trouble. Our gospel, instead, is more about the new creation. The new creation that was begun in Christ, when God did his takeover, as it were, of this world. And when did that happen? Well, it started largely when Jesus was born. Oh, there have been preparations long before through Abraham and the prophets and others saying, this is coming, this is coming. And when Christ shows up, we've entered the battle. I think last week I spoke about passing by a church that said that Christmas was a calm night that stilled the chaos. Now, I understand what that church is trying to say, okay? Maybe we could say in many ways it was a silent night, it was a holy night. Maybe. I'm not saying as soon as Jesus came that immediately all hell broke loose. I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying all hell certainly took notice. This was an opening shot. This was something that would not have been undetected by the rest of the world. And if the account of the Magi is accurate, which we'll be getting into some no doubt today, then this would have been known in advance with the Star of Bethlehem. And no, I can't really tell you right now what I think the star was. I have no firm opinions on it. But from what we get in Matthew with the slaughter of the infants, we can understand that Jesus would probably have been around 2 years old, probably younger a little bit, when the slaughter took place. So there had been some time of preparation. The star had been known well, and it was an announcement to the Magi that, yes, the king has been born. Keep in mind, those Magi most likely would have come from a nation that was not friendly to the Roman Empire, and Herod would not really be wanting to see these enemies on his doorstep coming to him and saying, hey, we're here to see the new king. Especially since Herod was a very paranoid fellow. Anyway, that's me talking for a little bit. Right now, though, I'm going to go ahead and take the first commercial break right now. And I'm Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
I am
And we're back to our show. I'm Nick Peters with the Deeper Waters Podcast. We're just talking about Christmas right now. And if you want to join in, our number is 714-242-5180. And I'd like to remind you that later on, we're going to have Ben Witherington be our guest. I'll be calling him up right here from the studio, which for me is conveniently located right outside of my own home. Yes, a whole online studio thing. But I'll be calling him up from here, and we'll be talking through to the end of the show then about Christmas. So, now getting back to where we were, Herod was indeed a very paranoid fellow, and he would not have taken lightly to a new king being announced. So this leads to the question, okay, if the slaughter took place, why would it not be mentioned? Well, here's a question I have back. Why should it be? This was one of a male for Herod, who would often butcher his own family, going to a small town and killing what would be about a dozen toddlers and younger, would not have been noteworthy news. Now, Josephus would record the killing of Herod's sons because that does affect political events. That has to do with who's going to be the next king and such. But he wouldn't record this. I mean, for all he knew, this could cause the families to be in trouble with the Roman Empire again. You know, families that were already fleeing and living in despair since Jerusalem had been destroyed. Why bring it up again? What good would it serve? It would really add nothing to the account. And we have this strange idea then that if the Bible mentions something and Josephus didn't mention it, then the Bible must be wrong. Well, who came up with this idea? And why should I take it seriously? Why should I think Josephus or the Bible, either one, are giving us exhaustive accounts? I shouldn't. Now, looking to what I was saying earlier here, about the fear of something pagan coming and Christmas being more of an opening shot, it's that Christmas is to remind us that God did come into this world to save sinners and to establish his kingdom forever. And here we're supposed to be going out sharing with people the good news that the kingdom is advancing by leaps and bounds, and what are we doing? We're running from pagans instead. We're living in fear as if the pagans are advancing on us. No, no, we're supposed to be advancing on them. Remember what's said in Matthew 16? The gates of hell will not stand up against the church. Well, people, gates are defensive measures. The world is supposed to be on the defense. We are supposed to be on the offense. And too often, we're not. We're running. We're retreating. We're sticking our heads in the sand and ignoring anything else out there. Now, people, ignoring the problem won't make it go away. And I talked about J.P.'s book. He wrote something earlier today about, earlier yesterday actually, about the Freedom From Religion Foundation going after ministers who have tax exemption for, I believe, their housing. Now, here is the ironic part. Freedom From Religion is Dan Barker's organization. This is a guy who even takes seriously the idea that Jesus never even existed. The church had all the means to deal with someone like this a long time ago, and we never did. And our failure to educate the Dan Barkers of the world lead to them becoming some of our worst enemies after they leave the church. Because when these people leave the church, they feel like they've been duped by the church. They've been lied to by the church. The church is full of people who don't care about intellectual questions. They're just trying to get an emotional high or feel good about themselves or things of that sort. And you know what? In many cases, I think they're right. I think the church is guilty of some of this because while we should have the life of the heart, the life of the emotions, the life shared with other people, that is important. But we're also not to neglect the life of the mind. Now, there are a number of people out there who will get the most connection to God through the life of the mind. I consider myself to be one of them. You give me a good intellectual book on Christianity that explains to me something about the doctrine of God, the nature of the kingdom, the resurrection, something along those lines, and well, all of a sudden, I am having a deeply Christian experience. At the men's group that I attend recently, we had a meeting, in fact, where we started talking about the evidences of Christianity, and my eyes were lighting up the whole time. You know, our leader could just tell that I was getting thoroughly, thoroughly excited about all this. You know, I realize some of you aren't that way. Okay, that's fine. I'm not going to begrudge you any, okay? Some of you will be more connected when you hear powerful music at church. God bless you. Okay, I think that's awesome. Some of you will be more connected if you go to a soup kitchen and serve the homeless and hungry there. God bless you. That's awesome also. Some of you will be connected through Christian artwork. That's great as well. Some of you are not doing something immoral. If it helps you connect and grow in your Christian life, I don't really have a problem with it, okay? But we can't neglect the life of the mind. And everyone should have some awareness of the life of the mind. Just like everyone should have some awareness of Christian music, serving those in need, Christian art, etc. We need a whole integrated Christian life. We just need to realize some of us will have strengths in one area, but others don't. And that's okay. That's just fine. It's one body with many parts. Not all of us are meant to be the brains of the operation, to put it that way. Some of us are meant to be much more heart-oriented than the rest of us are. If you look at mine and Allie's relationship, you're going to find that. People come to us, they have no doubt I'm the brain in the family. And they have no doubt that Allie's the heart in the family. I can be fairly cold on my own. Allie's the one who warms me up, okay? She's the one who's softened me the most. But at the same time, she needs my intellectual support as well. And so, because of that, we can work very, very well together. We complement each other greatly. Because there are times I can be so caught up in my academic pursuits that I will overlook a simpler truth. And sometimes, Allie, not being as academically inclined, has a different look on things. And she'll explain them, and I'll say, that does seem like a good way to see things. It's a great benefit to me. Now, when we get to Christmas, then, we need to realize Christmas is indeed God's taking over the world, and he's starting in the most unusual way. It is the way we would never have expected. And God says when you're testing, he's going to do something incredible, something that we would not believe even if we were told. Even if we'd been told this in advance, I think we would have had a hard time believing it. And in some cases, we were, depending on how you view prophecy. Anyway, I don't think people would have looked at the Old Testament and picked out what happened in the life of Jesus and said, yep, that's what we can expect. they were caught by surprise, because everyone had these ideas of what the Messiah was supposed to do, but no one was really expecting this Messiah would just come as an innocent little baby born to poor parents and in a less than honorable condition. No one was expecting that. And most people say, well, surely if this was the Son of God, something different would have happened. Yeah, that's what we might expect, but no. No. When we get to Philippians 2, we see that Jesus willingly took upon himself the life of a slave, and he chose a poor life, essentially life, where he had to depend on others. And, of course, most especially, he had to depend on God. This was essential. He took upon himself the form of a slave. A slave to God, especially. This is something I get at in my blog post on Jesus is not worth talking about, and also why arguments from silence are weak. If you want to see these, go to deeperwaters.wordpress.com. You'll find them there. But Jesus never went into battle. He never led an army. He never ran for political office. Aside from his parents taking him to Egypt for a little while when he was a toddler, an infant, he never really traveled, not outside of Palestine. And to make matters worse, he died the most shameful death that was around at the time. He did all this. And what was all this? All this was still the attack. Yeah. Because in the midst of this, Jesus was teaching and doing exorcisms and performing all other kinds of miracles. And these miracles and exorcisms, they weren't just Jesus showing off and saying, hey, look what I can do. They also weren't Jesus saying, hey, I'm God, worship me. That's the argument we seem to get the most out of the Gospels, especially when Jehovah's Witnesses come by us. Look, Jesus is showing he's God. Jesus is showing he's God. Well, that wasn't the main point he was showing, though. The main idea Jesus is giving in his miracles is he's giving us an idea of what the world is like when he's king. I've compared it to a political campaign. When Jesus is going around saying, repent, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, I think of it as saying, it's me, Jesus, vote for me for Messiah. Of course, they didn't have voting and such back then, but that's the kind of parallel I want you to see. Jesus is saying, are you going to side with me? Are you going to accept me as your Messiah or not? And it gets even stricter, of course, for Jesus. Siding with him is siding with God. And saying, if you do not accept my claims, you do not accept the claims of God. There was no middle ground. That's why Jesus is seen, just part of why Jesus is seen, as one of the most, no, the most incredible life that has ever lived. Every intelligent person today who's educated has to learn to answer this question somehow. Who is Jesus? You know, this is fascinating with Jesus because he's one figure in history that we really ask this question about. We don't often ask, who was Napoleon? Who was Alexander the Great? Who was Hitler? No, we have a general idea. Now, there are some mysteries that surround some people. male unknowns, but there isn't nearly as much of that as there is with Jesus, because everything seemed to be wrapped around not just what he did, but his identity. Jesus staked everything on his relationship to God and his view of himself as the king that God has chosen. Now, this is a pretty audacious claim on the face of it. And if you're going to make a claim like this, well, as the saying goes, you'd better be right. But Jesus made it. And here's interesting about him. We don't really view Jesus as someone arrogant, normally. Somehow, Jesus has come to be a picture of humility for us. And I'm not denying that. I affirm he was humble. But how did we get to that position? It's like this is a guy who shows up and claims, I am the king of the Jews. I am your Messiah. If you oppose me, you oppose the work of God in this world. Now, if I showed up today on the show and I was making similar claims, you would turn your radio off right quick and say, well, there goes another quack right now. But somehow with Jesus, we're not doing that. And say what you will about the Pharisees and Sadducees who opposed him back in those days. I'll tell you one thing they had going in their favor. They took him seriously. Dare I say, they took him much more seriously than most of us do today. Have we really looked and wrestled with what Jesus said and did? Have we really took the time to think about the life of Jesus? Have we found a way to explain who this figure is? Now, if we want to say, well, these are legends that build up around him later on, well, okay. First off, you know what? You can say that. That's fine. That's your choice. Here's my question. Why should I say that? Why should I think this is the case? In fact, since Jesus was crucified, why would anyone make up any legends at all? They would have nothing to gain by saving the movement. The hardest message they could have ever chosen to argue was that a crucified man was the Savior of the world, the Son of God, and the Messiah. There isn't a much harder message you can give than that one, and especially the Jews. And what do we find? We find that's the exact message that the church was saying. Why? If the resurrection didn't happen, why spread all these ideas about Jesus and, in fact, pretty much immediately give him a spot in the divine identity? That's not just making a statement about Jesus. That's making a statement about God, period. Why did they do it? The best answer I can give you is they knew it was true. And that's the kind of question we need to be asking today. Well, I'm going to take another quick break, one more break, and then we'll have Ben Witherington on. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphones, and tablets. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And we're back to our show now. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. The call number is 714-242-5180. Remember, at the top of the hour, we are calling Ben Witherington, and we are going to talk about the Christmas birth narrative. It's going to be a fascinating hour with an excellent scholar. Let me tell you about Dr. Witherington. I've been told for since he has an amazing memory. He pretty much remembers everything that he reads. I have met some people who think I do that. No, I wish I did. Okay, but I have to look things up from time to time still, too. And I was looking at Ben Witherington's books on Amazon, and I see 58 books listed there. This isn't counting just journal articles, classes taught, talks delivered, things of that sort. This is books. And he's written commentaries on nearly every book of the Bible. Now that is a very, very impressive feat. Because usually scholars will spend a few years working to write just one commentary. This is a guy who's written 58 books, and some of them are commentaries, and he's covered nearly every book in the Bible. Now, a lot of these commentaries also are socio-rhetorical commentaries, which means they also deal in the social context and use of language in the New Testament. And this is an area of study that is way too often neglected by New Testament scholars. Most defenses of a resurrection, such as I see, they don't mention it. There's not much mention of the honor-shame culture and how much this meant. And I consider this a shame. For instance, my own father-in-law, Mike Lacona, for instance, his book on the resurrection, it's excellent. I'm not going to deny that. And I wrote a review of it when it came out, and I did state bias that, yeah, I'm related to him by marriage, so if you want to take what I say with a grain of salt, but this is an excellent book. But I did have to give one criticism. I said, I didn't see enough in here on the honor-shame culture that the Bible was written in. I would like to have seen more. And he knows that. He read it on Amazon as well. And I mean, he appreciated what I said, but I was forthright and honest. This is something that I really do want to see some more research done in. And Ben Witherington has done this research. In the books that I've read by him, they're lively and engaging and very enjoyable. He knows how to interact with the ideas that are out there. And so it's just thrilling to know he's going to be our guest. And I'd like to remind you of with these scholars that come on, they are taking their free time to come on here. They don't get paid anything because, frankly, I couldn't pay it. Most you could say is they get some free publicity. But a large part of the reason they come on here is because they want to help you all out. They want to help you, the listener, so you can be equipped. And, you know, with Christmas coming up, we've got a great opportunity because this is one time of the year we've got where religion is on everyone's mind. And not just religion, but specifically the Christian religion. People are talking about Jesus this time of the year. And we can go and deal with all those bogus shows that they have on, say, the History Channel, for instance. What a terrible place to get biblical information. Ugh. And we can also deal very easily with the new atheist crowd, especially the ones that want to say that it's all a myth. fact, even the idea that Jesus even lived is a myth. Now, there are several scholars out there who don't hold to the resurrection, who don't hold to the Orthodox view of Jesus, who don't believe that he did miracles, okay? But they're not going to go so far as to say that Jesus never even existed. In fact, they're quite frankly argue against this position. The number one example I can think of right now is Bart Ehrman. He even has a book out. I've got it right here called Did Jesus Exist? And he's pretty much taken this time to write this book because he's gotten tired of people coming to him with that kind of question over and over, and sometimes even citing him as someone who denies Jesus' existence. We'll say, no, I don't deny his existence at all. In fact, if you've ever heard the show where he was on the Infidel Guys program, and he was asked if Jesus lived, it is really a fascinating time, especially when you also get into the authorship of the Book of Galatians and how the Infidel Guys, we're assuming Paul wrote it. And Ehrman says along the lines of, I know 300 scholars in the Society of Biblical Literature. Not one of them doubts that Paul wrote Galatians. You know, this new atheist anti-intellectualism on their part. Yes, in this case, it is anti-intellectualism. There are Christians who are anti-intellectuals. I think there are atheists who are anti-intellectuals as well. Because the problem both sides can often have is they're skeptical of the other side. They're not skeptical enough of their own side. They don't ask enough of the hard questions. And I've consistently tried to ask the hard questions on my own side as well. That's why there are even reviews of, outright, of books on Christian apologetics and say, these aren't that good. And if someone wants to say the atheist movement is criticizing the Christian church today, I'll say not nearly as much as I am. And I'll stand up and I'll say I'm one of the staunchest critics of the church. But for me, it's for a different reason. Because I love the church. And I don't want to see it fall. It's the Church of Christ. It's his kingdom that's supposed to take over this world. Not mine. So when we're dealing with these kinds of atheists out there, if we don't even know how to answer the question that Jesus lived, we're certainly not going to be able to answer the other questions. And I guarantee you, if the atheist movement actually thought that Christians were really able to engage with them, they would not be as prolific as they are right now. In fact, they wouldn't be making the kinds of arguments and such that they're making, because they know these kinds of arguments are getting me thoroughly embarrassed, because those Christians out there know how to answer them. A lot of the arguments you see on YouTube and the blogosphere and places like that, I've been doing this for quite some time now. Rarely anymore, in fact, do I find one of these that makes me blink anymore, honestly. And I can say the arguments on the other side are getting worse and worse. And in fact, from a Christian position, we're getting more and more evidence coming in. We had Dr. Paul Meyer on the show last week. And he spent some time talking about archaeological findings that have bolstered our trust in the New Testament. The one that he thinks is the best one, other than probably the Dead Sea Scrolls, is our finding of the bones of Caiaphas. You know, he said he spoke to a group of pastors, and they did not know about this. You know, this really surprised me. I knew about it. And I'm not one who regularly watches archaeologists, but I knew about it. I know about quite a few other findings, but we have found this character as talked about in the New Testament and plays a pretty big role in the Gospels. He's been found. We have found the evidence of Pontius Pilate. You know, there are some people who ask me about why is it that we should choose Christianity over all the other religions out there. I always answer with one word, resurrection. Christianity is built on a historical foundation, on a historical claim. It's built on the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Now, if you can show the resurrection to be false, then by all means, it's time to abandon Christianity and move on. But if you can't, then you better take a good look at it. Centuries ago, Thomas Sherlock wrote a book where he had a trial set up to argue the resurrection. And he said it very forthrightly in that book, accept the miracle or prove the fraud. He has a tough charge because if there wasn't a miracle that took place, there was some kind of fraud that took place because we have to have the facts explained. We have to have the fact explained that Jesus came and his story fits in so well with the Old Testament and the promises given to the patriarchs and the prophets. That he died a shameful death. That his tomb was found empty. That his followers claimed to see him alive after his death. And that skeptics like Paul and James joined the Christian movement. These have to be explained. Now, I'll tell you that I think if you have also independent evidence of the existence of God, as I think I do, and yeah, I use fatimistic arguments, but if you have those on your side, then if you have reason to believe there is some God out there, it makes it a lot easier to believe this God has spoken then. Because after all, if you don't have theism at the start, you can't have a hard time believing that any sort of being has spoken. And I'm not saying you can't do it the other way. I mean, Lee Strobel, for instance, in case of Christ, pretty much focuses only on the Christ question. And yeah, he gets to God through it. He realizes God has spoken. And I'm not condemning that way, but I also think that if you go the other way, it can be a lot easier. And this is in a project we call the classical approach. Now, when I do meet someone who is a skeptic of Christianity, I usually do start off with what they talk about. And if they want to talk about Jesus first, well, okay, we talk about Jesus first. If they want to talk about theism first, we'll talk about theism first. That's why I usually say that I switch between the classical modes and the evidential modes back and forth. It all depends on where the person that I'm talking to is coming from. So, getting to what's been said in all this, is that if we, the church, are busy educating ourselves, we will be prepared when opposition arises. And if we're not prepared right now, then the question we have to ask is, have we really been busy preparing ourselves? Or have we just been focusing on ourselves? Have we made Christianity a religion simply of orthopraxy, which is living rightly? That's why I think people bring up this objection that you don't have to believe in God to be a good person. Yeah, I agree. You don't have to be a Christian to be a good person. Yeah, I agree. But I've never once said the reason God came is so that we would all be good people. We're supposed to be. I think that's what Christ calls us to be. The reason Christ came ultimately was to deal with the problem of evil and establish the kingdom of God on this earth. Both of those work together. Because when God's kingdom takes over, evil is no longer a problem. Now that includes our being good people. That includes us being Christ-honoring. That includes our salvation. It includes our salvation because we've all been living in rebellion to this God who's declaring himself king. And if we don't submit, we're traitors to the throne. And it's not going to work to say, look at everything else we've done, if we're also being traitors. If you're a traitor to the government or the kingdom, anywhere else, and you come to them and say, ah, but I've been a good person, look at all these other good things I've done, they're not going to care. You're still guilty of a crime to the government, and you're to be held responsible. And for Christianity, God will hold you responsible. And in fact, if you don't meet his standard of righteousness, he's only got one thing he's going to be able to judge you on. Guess what that is? Your works. He's going to be fair. Those works have to be perfect. He's not going to set some sort of arbitrary standard. He's going to say, it's either all perfect, or you don't meet the standard. That's it. There's nothing arbitrary about it. And it's not about going to heaven when you die. That makes it seem like it's all about us. No, it's about Christ coming and ruling. It's not about abandoning earth so we can get to heaven. It's about rescuing earth so heaven can come down here. We're on a rescue mission, essentially. What we are doing is, as Peter Kreeft says, our apologetics is the closest you come to saving the world. You can find that saying in the handbook of Christian apologetics I wrote with Tricelli. And it's the same that I read years ago, and I agree with. And as you can tell, it's stuck with me to this day. It's a powerful statement. Well, right now, I'm going to go ahead and start getting us ready for the break. And I'll be calling and getting Ben Witherington on the line, so this could be a little bit of a longer break than normal, but I hope when you come back, we have Dr. Ben Witherington with us. I'm Nick Peters, Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
I'm currently unavailable, but if you would please leave your name and number, and I'll return your call as soon as possible.
Hi, this is Ben Witherington.
Hi, Dr. Witherington, great to have you. Hello?
Hello, this is Ben Witherington. I cannot hear you, nor did my phone ring when you tried to call me.
Okay, can you hear me now? Hello?
I cannot hear you at all. I'm going to hang up. You can try and call me again.
Okay, everyone. I'm going to be speaking from my main line here, and I'm going to try and call back Ben Witherington now and see if I can get him on the line here.
I'm currently unavailable, but if you would please leave your name and number, and I'll return your call as soon as possible. Thank you.
Hello?
Dr. Witherington.
Yes?
Okay, can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Okay, good. We seem to have had some sort of difficulties. I hope everything's working fine on our end. I have no idea what went wrong, but it's great to have you on the show. In case my listeners don't know, can you tell them a little bit about who you are?
I'm the Amos Professor for Doctoral Studies at Asbury Theological Seminary, and I'm on the doctoral faculty at St. Andrews University in Scotland. I teach New Testament.
Okay, and yeah, I was telling them about your resume that I'd seen online, how impressive it is that you've written a commentary on practically every book of the New Testament.
I have indeed.
And today we're going to talk to you about the birth narratives of Christ.
Okay.
And yeah, I was just putting on my headset because I'm having to use a different phone for this show. And so let's just start at the beginning. When we start with birth notice, we turn to Matthew, and there's a genealogy right at the start. And
yep.
That gives us some problems, because when we turn and look in the third chapter of Luke, that genealogy seems to be different.
Yep. It
so
certainly
how
is.
So how do we explain this? I mean, did the gospel writers just get the genealogy of the main character wrong? I mean, there's even a different person listed as the father on each account. How do we explain this?
Well, ancient genealogies are not like modern ones. Ancient genealogies, among other things, are often segmented and selective. And, I mean, there's such a thing as a patrilineal genealogy, and there's a matrilineal genealogy, one that's traced through the father, others are traced through the mother. In the genealogy in Matthew, you don't have a complete genealogy. You have whole generations skipped. And that's not unusual in ancient genealogies. In fact, it's especially not unusual in royal genealogies. You leave your skeletons in the closet. You don't parade them out in front of everybody. And there are various other reasons why there would not be a complete genealogy. But in any case, the genealogy in Matthew is very clearly Joseph's genealogy. It's a begat, 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 begat genealogy. It's Joseph's. And so the most important thing to ask is, how in the world did Mary get shoehorned into Joseph's genealogy, since it's a patrilineal or male genealogy? Well, of course it was necessary, because Jesus had only one human parent, and that would be Mary, not Joseph. But here's where a knowledge of early Judaism helps. If a father adopts a child, according to the rules of early Judaism, that child is entitled to inherit from the father everything, including the father's genealogy, even though we would call that person a stepson, you know, or sort of some other kind of non-lineal relationship to Joseph. In the Jewish way things work, adoption entitles you even to your father's genealogy, as well as his name. And so, I mean, some of the things that would be problematic for us are not really problematic when you understand how first century genealogies work. In regard to Luke's genealogy, you know, there are both descending and ascending genealogies. Matthew's genealogy doesn't start with the beginning of humanity. It's a descending genealogy, which ends with Joseph, the husband of Mary, who was the mother of Jesus. But what you have in Luke is an ascending genealogy. That is, one that starts with the present person in question, in this case, Jesus, and works back. And the genealogy in Matthew, it's incomplete. It's not a whole genealogy. It was never intended to be a whole genealogy. The church fathers suggested that it's possible that the Luke genealogy is traced back through everybody has two sets of grandparents. There's a grandfather and a grandmother on both sides of the family. Has been suggested that the Lucan genealogy is traced back. It is Joseph's genealogy, but it's traced back through the matrilineal line to Adam rather than the patrilineal line. It's possible, but the real question to be asked about these genealogies is not how do we reconcile them, because they have two very different purposes. I mean, that would be like asking, how do you reconcile the National League and the American League in baseball? Well, you don't. They both play the same game, but they play it somewhat differently. Well, that's true about these two genealogies as well. The question is, what is the purpose of these genealogies? It's not to give you everything you ever wanted to know about Jesus' ancestors but were afraid to ask. In Luke, the point of the genealogy is to make clear that Jesus is a true human being, thus ultimately the son of Adam, the first human being. I mean, that's the point. The point is not to say anything about Jesus' royal lineage or anything like that, whereas no question in Matthew, the issue is his. It's a messianic genealogy. He's the royal son of David. It's crucial that he be seen as son of Abraham, son of David, not son of Adam, who was the forefather of all humanity. So you could say that the genealogy in Matthew is a much more fully, truly Jewish genealogy than the one in Luke. And this reflects different purposes of the two evangelists. That's part of what's going on. Now, the most fascinating thing about the Matthean genealogy is this, that genealogy has four unusual women in it.
Mm-hmm.
And women who had unusual liaisons, shall we say, or irregularities in their life, including the wife of Uriah, none other than Bathsheba. Well, how did David... son Solomon come into this world? Well, actually through adultery, right? That's what I would call an irregular union. And so why the question to be asked is, why would Matthew highlight those kinds of things, which he does at four places? I mean, it's very unusual to mention women at all in a patrilineal genealogy. And why these women? I mean, why do we have Tamar in there? You know, I mean, what's the point of that? Well, I think the point of that is to show that even in a messianic story, even in a messianic genealogy, even with that being the case, God can produce kings through highly irregular sexual arrangements. Of course, that means that those cases of those other four women are a foreshadowing of what is the case with Mary. A highly irregular something happened which produced Jesus, namely a virginal conception.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that start, and you've only got a couple minutes left in this segment before our break, but let's get started a little bit then on that virginal conception here, and I'll let you know when the break's coming. But I mean, Dr. Rivington, we live in this advanced age of science and such, and so many people say it's hard to believe in a virgin birth. I mean, why should we think a virgin birth really happened?
Well, I don't know why it's so hard in a scientific age to believe that. Any scientist worth their salt can tell you there's such a thing as spontaneous genesis. It happens. It happens with other sentient beings. Why shouldn't it happen with human beings as well? But what is usually objected to is the idea that this was somehow miraculous, not just highly unusual from a natural point of view, which spontaneous genesis would be, but miraculous. I mean, that's what's usually objected to. Now, I mean, my own conversation with scientists, including my classmate at Carolina, Francis Collins, who is the head of the NIH and the head of the Human Genome Project, you know, he has no problems with miracles at all. And the reason is not just because he has faith, is a person of Christian faith. The reason is because any scientist who gets up and takes his humility pill in the morning knows perfectly well that there's a huge array of things that science has not yet figured out or cannot explain. And so the main thing that he would say is science has no ability to rule out the possibility of a miracle. And any scientist like Richard Dawkins or Stephen Hawking, who says silly things like that, is making actually a faith statement, not a science statement, a faith statement. And that is, we might call it an anti-faith statement. It's not a statement based on facts. It's a statement based on assumptions that miracles don't happen because they can't happen. Well, now that's a faith statement. That's not based on any empirical data. It's a faith statement. There are certainly just as many testimonies to the reality of actual supernatural miracles as there are testimonies against it. So who do you believe, right? So, you know, I don't really think that modern skepticism settles the issue. And even within the context of science, most scientists are not going to make global claims like miracles don't happen because they can't happen. There are very few that are put the dog back in dogmatic and will say things like that because they know they don't have an exhaustive knowledge of reality. They do not have an exhaustive knowledge of reality, so they certainly cannot rule miracles out. So, I mean, that's part of the issue. But, again, we're not talking about just any kind of miracle. We're talking about the virginal conception. Why would that particular miracle be important or necessary to bring the Son of God into this world?
Well, Dr. Withington, before we go and continue that question, I'm going to take a quick break here for my listeners. And now I'm here with Dr. Ben Withington, and we'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcasts, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I'm Nick Peters. We're back here. My guest right now is Dr. Ben Withington. We're discussing the birth narratives for our Christmas shows. Now, I'd like to remind everyone that this is listener-supported, so please do consider making donations to us and making to Blog Talk Radio. If you want to support what I'm doing personally here, you just go to peoplebarters.wordpress.com, donate there, or you can donate to me through Risen Jesus or even through Professor Christie Issues and Answers session. I'm a man with many hats. But we are here with Ben Withington, and we're talking about the genealogy, the birth narratives and such. But we've talked about the virgin birth a little bit, but is there any positive evidence on the other hand? Because pagan accounts are usually full of miraculous births and such. Is there any reason why we should give the Christian account the credibility over all the other accounts?
Well, first of all, there is no accounts in either ancient Near Eastern literature or Greek or Roman literature of a virginal conception. There are accounts of gods mating with human beings and producing a child, but that's quite explicitly not what we have in Matthew and Luke. There's no mating going on. There's no God coming down from heaven under the guise of a human being and mating with a human woman. That's simply not what either Matthew or Luke say. So, first of all, those parallels are not parallels. And secondly, those stories are mythological stories to begin with, and nobody disputes that. Now, I mean, we're talking about an honor and shame Jewish culture. The idea that a religion like early Christianity would make up a story that to any normal person would suggest that Mary got pregnant out of wedlock by normal means, and somebody's trying to cover it up. The idea that an evangelistic religion like Christianity would make up a story like this, which would cause them problems, and certainly did cause them problems. Very early on, even in the 2nd century AD, we have Jewish apologetics suggesting that Jesus was the product of a Roman soldier named Panthera and Mary. Yep. And we see this in Origen's debate with Celsus, another Jewish apologist as well. just the very idea that early Christians would make up the idea of a virginal conception is highly improbable. No, something happened in the life of Mary that they had to explain. And I should explain one other thing. Isaiah 7:14. What the Hebrew of Isaiah 7:14 says is, a young woman shall conceive and give birth to a child, and we shall call his name Emmanuel. In other words, the Hebrew does not use a technical term for virgin there. So early Jews who knew their Hebrew were not reading Isaiah 7:14 as predicting a virginal conception. It is true that the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, has parthenos there, which is what Matthew is quoting, which does say, a virgin shall conceive and give birth to a child, and his name shall be called Emmanuel. Now, here's the thing about that. So far as I can tell, all of the early Jews who read that verse, read that prophecy, before people like Matthew and Luke came along, understood that to mean a virgin will conceive by ordinary means, that is, she's going to have a husband, and give birth to a child, and he's going to be a royal child, and he'll get a throne name. Emmanuel not being a proper name, being a throne name of a king. Okay? It is only after the fact that evangelists like Luke and Matthew are scrambling around saying, well, this is what happened to Mary. There was a virginal conception. No man was involved. There must be something in the Old Testament about that. We've got to go back and find out where it is. And so what they did, of course, is in light of what had actually happened to Mary, they found this prophecy that, while it wasn't explicit, nonetheless comported with the idea that there would be a virginal conception. And so it was used to show that that's what God intended all along. So, I don't really think the parallels with the pagan stories work, because we're not talking about divine rape here like you are in the Greco-Roman stories.
Yeah. You know, I really also liked how you brought up the influence of the honor or shame culture. That's what I find fascinating about the context group and such. And we had David Insom Brewer on back in April, who was saying the same thing in his book, The Jesus Scandal, that virgin birth would have been a scandal to them.
Well, absolutely it would be, because, you see, I mean, the thing about that is, first of all, this is a highly patriarchal culture. And the big job of women was to protect the inner life of the family and the sexual integrity of the family. So virginity was extremely highly prized, and is to this day in an honor and shame culture like Oriental cultures, very highly prized. Middle Eastern cultures, still, very highly prized. The one way a woman could most shame either her birth family or the family of her husband or husband-to-be is to have sex before she got married or sex outside of marriage. That's the one way she could most mess up. And that's why you have such stringent Levitical laws about what happens when you're dealing with an adulteress, for example.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea that Christians would sit around and make up a story about a virginal conception and it not dawn on them that, gee, the very first thought of some skeptic is going to be, oh, she did something shameful. Obviously she did, you know, and that's exactly what the critique of Christianity was at that point. So the bottom line is, this story is too improbable not to be true. It has to have a historical nucleus to it. There has to be a basis in history to this, because you don't make up stories like this if you want to convince somebody that Jesus is the Messiah. It just doesn't work.
Now, let's move on through the gospel narratives. When we get to the chapter of Luke, we find a scenario that's caused much debate amongst Christians and atheists, and that's the census that takes place. When did the census take place? When was Quirinius governor? And doesn't Luke have the timing of this whole thing wrong, since we have no records of such a census?
Yeah, okay. First of all, We do know that it was the regular practice of the emperor to have sensei, plural, taken in all of their provinces regularly for the purpose of taxation. I mean, there are very clear records. I mean, the one place where we have clear evidence of records that have survived is, of course, Egypt, because of the dry, arid conditions. We have lots of documents from the period of the Roman Empire in regard to this matter. And we know, in fact, that there were provincial censuses taken for the purpose of taxation. And furthermore, in some of those records, what is suggested is that you have to go to your ancestral home to do it. Now, isn't that interesting? Because if that's, of course, what the gospel story says. Mary and Joseph needed to go to Bethlehem because that's the ancestral home of Joseph. That's why that was necessary in the first place. In regard to Luke and that census, we need to bear in mind that, in fact, the Greek can be read several ways.
Yeah.
My point would be that the most probable way to read the Greek is that what Luke says is, this was the census, that is the one involving Mary and Joseph, this was the census before the famous Quirinius census, which took place during the time of Judas the Galilean. Now, if that's how it reads, there is not any kind of historical problem here. It simply means that we don't have a record of the census that they are talking about. We do have a record of the famous one taken during the time of Judas the Galilean, which produced the Jewish revolt of Jewish the Galilean. Here's the other thing. Quirinius was a ruler in the area for a long time. Now, what we need to remember is before Judea became a Roman province, that is, for example, during the time of Herod the Great, which is the time when Jesus was born, Judea was not a Roman province at all. It was under the directorship of the legate in Syria, and that just happened to be Quirinius. Okay? Now, once there was a province called Judea, which is after the time of Herod the Great, and after his son Archelaus totally failed to be a good ruler in Judea and very quickly was replaced by a whole string of procurators, once that happens, then you have a provincial census that would be regularly taken. Okay? So, clearly, Luke is writing at a time when Judea is a province. And his audience will only know Judea as a province. I mean, Theophilus, probably Luke Acts is written in the last third of the first century A.D. Theophilus is not going to know about a day and age where Rome indirectly controlled Judea through Syria. He's not going to know about that. And so Luke has framed the way he puts that to explain that there was a census before the famous one that Quirinius took somewhere around 6 A.D., and that's the one at the time in which Jesus was born.
Yeah, that's why also when we read in Acts, when we talk about how something took place during the census, that there were many censi that took place, but when someone talks about the census, the one of Judas the Galilean was a census everyone remembered, right?
Absolutely. It was a notorious census because it produced an early version of the Jewish rebellion. And, I mean, the other thing you have to keep in mind throughout this whole period leading up to AD 70 when the temple goes down for the count, it is there were a series of Jewish smaller and larger rebellions. There were zealots plotting to do away with the Herods, plotting to do away with the Romans. And then it blew up into a full-fledged war in the 60s, leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And this happened again in the early 2nd century with the Bar Kokhba revolt as well. So one of the things that should be clear to all of us is that this is a volatile region. just as it is today, full of hotheads. And all of that kind of thing was going on. So we should stop asking stupid questions about, well, why would procurators or rulers be nervous about the situation? Why would Herod the Great go slaughter a bunch of innocents? I'll tell you why. He was paranoid about losing his power. He even killed some of his own wives and children to prevent losing power. Any threat or possibility of there being another king on the horizon that would off him or throw him off his throne, he was going to do away with that person and with dispatch and make sure that that didn't happen. And the procurators as well were equally nervous in the service as well. They were equally concerned about the volatility of the zealots and Jews who were chafing under the yoke of Roman rule.
Well, let's talk about that slaughter of infants, son, because that is a question a lot of atheists and skeptics bring forward up in the New Testament and say, well, Josephus records so many of the horrible acts of Herod, he never once mentions this one. Shouldn't that cause
He doesn't. Because Bethlehem was the ancient equivalent of Chitlin Switch, North Carolina. It's a one-stop light town. It's not on any major roads. And we're probably talking, at most, 6 to 8 infants. This is hardly a blip on the historical radar screen. I mean, you know, 6 to 8 people die in little villages due to violence from Romans all the time. It doesn't make the history books. We're not talking about hundreds of children lying in the streets. We're not talking about Cecil B. DeMille or big Hollywood productions. We're talking about a very small-scale event.
And as you said, Herod was an extremely paranoid ruler. And, in fact, if he sees something that, or he hears about an event that's a portent from the Magi, he's likely to be going internally berserk at that point, isn't he?
Well, and what we know is the further you get into his reign and closer to the end of his reign, the less rational he is, the less in control of his fears he is. So, I mean, absolutely. It seems very likely that Jesus is, first of all, we know Jesus was born while Herod the Great was still on the throne, because the slaughter of the innocents takes place after Jesus is born. And we don't know how long after. It could be a year or so. I mean, why exactly does Herod say to all infants 2 years of age and younger? Well, it would seem that this means that this took place sometime after the birth, right? Maybe considerably after. So in any case, what we know about the birth of Jesus, as odd as it may sound, is that Jesus was born somewhere between 2 and 6 B.C., which makes for a messed up calendar. So how did we get a messed up calendar? Well, it's Denny the Dwarf, otherwise known as Dionysius the Short. The calendar that we operate with now, which has the turn of the era where it does, was settled on by a medieval calculator, a monk. And he got it wrong. He was wrong by 2 to 6 years in regard to the date of the birth of Jesus. So, oddly enough, Jesus is actually born B.C.
Well, we'll go ahead and take our final break, Barry, so when we come back, we'll have the rest of the show dedicated to the birth narratives. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back with Finn Witherington after this break.
Oh, yeah. Hey folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys gotta check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That again is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
And I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. We're back with Dr. Ben Witherington for our final segment where we're discussing the birth narratives. In fact, we had Tim McGrew on our show back several months ago, and one thing he says that Josephus was also mainly interested in the political aspect. So he decried Herod curing his own son because, hey, that affects who's going to be the next king. But this kind of event wouldn't really matter whatsoever to him.
Not really. You're right. And I mean, there are a lot of things that Josephus leaves out that are, like, in his mind, in his estimation, small blips on the radar screen. And that's not a surprise. I mean, it just wasn't his concern. Infant mortality rate, anyway, was so high in that whole era. I mean, that you have infants dying all the time, all over the place. This is a regular occurrence in any town, village, or city. So, you know, when we're talking about a very small town with a few more infants in these cases being killed, it's, you know, this is not going to make any major history book.
And unfortunately, we seem to have this standard in biblical studies that if you see something in the Bible, if it's not recorded elsewhere, it doesn't really count as history.
Well, there's a basic rule that most historians abide by. Absence of evidence does not equal evidence of absence.
Right.
That is, if you want to argue that something did not happen, you need to have reasons. You need to have evidence because we have a record that it did. And as long as you have a record that it did, the burden of proof is on the person who says it didn't happen. You have to come up with some evidence that it didn't happen.
Now, let's move on to what you were talking about also with the Magi and such, because there's a lot of debate also on this topic. Just who were the Magi and what was the star that they were following?
Yeah, this is a good question. The Magi, Magos Magi, these are astrologers. They are stargazers. That's who they are. First of all, they're not kings, so enough with the we three kings of Orient are. Enough with that. They are not kings. Astrologers, however, were counselors to the king. They were consultants to kings. This is one of the reasons Herod the Great wants to talk to them. This was very normal and natural in ancient royal courts. You would consult astrologers about the future. And the whole way ancient people viewed stars is different from us. I mean, when we think of stars, we think about inanimate matter in the sky. Maybe planets, maybe meteorites, maybe just stars, but in any case, inanimate matter. Most ancient people didn't view stars that way. I mean, they look. Think about it. They would go out at night. They'd look up in the sky. If they stayed there long enough, they could see the things move. They could see Orion's belt. They could see the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper, and it moved during the. Especially astrologers would chart how these things were moving. Well, now, what many ancient people concluded from that is, these are beings. These are alive creatures. These are the heavenly hosts. These are angels moving in the heavens. Now, why should we be surprised that some people would think that in a pre-scientific era? And so the big problem with reading the story about the Magi and whatever this was in the sky is it, in fact, a star or a planet or a comet? Or actually, are we talking about an angel? Which is perfectly possible, because that's how ancients would look at those things that were in the sky. What's especially suspicious about this story is that when the star really gets funky is from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. I mean, you could argue that there was a conjunction of Jupiter with another planet in 6 BC, and the Magi were following this, and that could have gotten them in the general vicinity of the Holy Land or Jerusalem. Okay, fair enough. That's possible. But there are no comets, no planets, and no stars that are going to moving from Jerusalem and then go to Bethlehem and then hover over the manger. This just this is not a natural phenomenon. It's just not. Right? So I'm saying I'm thinking we're probably talking about an angel here. You know, he doesn't need glow sticks, just an angel, right? The Magi may have begun by following stars and ended up for the specific directions between Jerusalem and Bethlehem by divine guidance. And, of course, the Bible is littered with stories about angels providing divine guidance, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, end of problem. I don't think there's a big difficulty with this. Now, here's another little interesting thing. Even in our modern or even postmodern skeptical era, there are now more people in America prepared to believe in angels than are prepared to believe in God.
Wow.
Now, that's very interesting. That is very
interesting. Doesn't make much sense.
No, well, right, exactly. They're prepared to believe in angels and demons more than they're prepared to believe in God. That being the case, this Christmas story might be a good point of entry for witnessing to people who already believe in angels but have serious doubts about God. This story might be useful for that purpose. Now, I have read the accounts of Kepler and others thinking that we can definitely come up with evidence of a convergence of two planets or some kind of comet like Halley's Comet, that kind of thing. I mean, I'm not ruling that out as a possibility, but it as an exegete who wants to focus on the particulars of the Greek text of what Matthew actually says, that would not explain what happened when the Magi left Jerusalem and went 6 miles away to Bethlehem. That just wouldn't explain that. And especially not the Greek verb that suggests that whatever this luminous thing was, it hovered directly over wherever Jesus was born. Planets don't do that, stars don't do that, and comets sure don't do that. So,
And where do these Magi come from?
Well, that's another whole debate. It depends on how you read the word Anatole. Anatolia is actually, and has been for many centuries, Eastern Turkey. It's possible that we're talking about astrologers from Eastern Turkey. Because look what they say. We saw his star where? Well, one translation would be in the east. That means they're in the west looking east. They're west of the Holy Land looking east. Well, that's possible. The other way to read Anatole would be we saw his star at its rising. That would also be in the east, but moving from east to west, right? Most scholars think they're probably Persian astrologers, and the Persians were the most famous astrologers in antiquity. They were counselors in courts all over the ancient Near East, and so it may well be true that they were from the eastern end of the Roman Empire and headed west towards the Holy Land. Two other little tidbits about that story. We are not told that there are three of them. We're simply told that there are plural magi. What we are told is that they gave three gifts. Now, two people can give three gifts. Four people can give three gifts. And we're certainly not told their names either. The story in Matthew tells us neither how many there were, except that there was more than one, nor are we told, what their names are. What we know for sure is that they were astrologers, so they probably at least began their journey following some kind of constellation or star pattern. And that's what we really know. The most interesting part, actually, about the story is the gifts themselves, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And here's why, just briefly. Gold is certainly a gift you give to a king. Frankincense is the perfume that you use to cover the huge amount of odor that existed in a hot, smelly region like the ancient Near East, especially in the summertime, right? It's the ancient equivalent of Chanel No. 5 or perfume. It's you would burn this stuff to cover the odor of body odor, which was prevalent everywhere in the ancient Near East. But myrrh is a whole different ballgame. Myrrh was used for burial purposes. It was used to wrap in the winding sheet to retard the odor of the corpse.
Mm-hmm.
That suggests that these are gifts for a king who was born, who will reign, and who will die.
Right.
Now, that's very interesting. Very odd Christmas present, don't you think? Here's something for your shroud for later. I don't think you really give babies that kind of thing. So what Matthew is doing is foreshadowing that this is the king who was born to die. Powerful point.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've got a theme of that, so let's spend a little bit of time talking about the shepherds. Now, our nativity scenes, and yeah, we've got one step here even that has the shepherds and the magi together, but really that wouldn't have happened that way, would it?
No. No, it's clear that the Magi came later. And just so people will know, the first nativity scene was created by Francis of Assisi in the Middle Ages. And he's the one who brought the animals into the picture. And from there, they came into the Christmas songs, okay? There is no mention of animals in the picture in either Matthew or Luke. What is mentioned is a corn crib or a manger. Now, this is the place where you would feed an animal, but here's where I tell you that the place you would normally keep your beast of burden in an ancient Near Eastern home is in the back of the house, not in a cave, and certainly not in a purpose-built barn, so enough with barns. That's an all-too-American view of the birth of Jesus. Could have happened in a cave, but it probably happened in the back of the ancestral house. Here's how I would translate the key verse in Luke. There was no room in the guest room, is what Luke actually says. The word there is kataluma, and everywhere else that Greek word appears in Luke Acts, it means the guest room. In fact, it's used in the Last Supper story. Somebody needs to go and prepare us a kataluma so we can share in the Passover. It's the very same word. And so I think this whole idea of Mary and Joseph trudging to Bethlehem late at night, knocking on the door of the Holiday Inn Express, and there's just no vacancy, so they end up in a barn, is a total myth. First of all, they didn't have barns in Bethlehem in that period of time. And secondly, the word means guest room. So what's happened here? Joseph and Mary go to the ancestral home. There's no room in the guest room because there are already other relatives who arrived to register for the census, right? So what do they do? Well, Mary's going to have a baby. She's preggers. And so they put her in the back of the house. And she lays the baby in the corn crib. They probably take the beast of burden out of the house, out of the back of the house. The structure of the ancient home is that there would be a wall near the back of the house, which you could access from in the house or outside of the house. And behind the wall is where you kept your most valuable animal. That's where you did it to protect it from theft. And we have archaeological evidence of this house structure all over the place, including in Capernaum. I inspected one that's in Capernaum. So I think that Jesus was born in the ancestral home. He was not rejected by his family. He was not rejected by an innkeeper or the world. He was born in the back of the house because there was no room in the guest room.
Yeah, Ken Bailey makes a similar case also in Jesus from Middle Eastern Eyes. The first time I came across it, and I found it fascinating when I read it from him.
Yeah, well, the archaeological evidence absolutely supports that. On the one hand, we've got no evidence that people had barns back then, and not like we're talking about. And on the other, and on the other hand, we have clear evidence from various first-century Jewish villages of houses that had a structure, a purpose-built structure that was part of the back of the house, where you would keep the most important beast of burden, like an ox.
Yeah, we got someone else who's apparently calling in and want to ask a question. You want to take a quick question?
Sure.
Okay. Yes, you're on the air with Dr. Whittington. We've only got a few minutes left, so make it quick.
Hi there. I'm on the air.
Yes.
Are you talking to me?
Yes.
Yeah. What's your question?
Sorry about that. I just want to say, first off, praise God. Thank you for taking my call. I've been waiting all day to get through to one of these good Christian radios. Lots of filth out there, so it's really good to... My question was, whenever you have people that are trying to destroy your talk radio show, trying to bring filth in here, I don't know what to do sometimes. I'm listening to these things, but it's always just somebody trying to mess with you guys. How do you combat that?
Well, right now, that's not really going on. But I can just tell you the main thing to do is you listen to our show regularly and check my blog, things of that sort. But it's really not happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, just how far can you fit a fist in your asshole?
Okay. Sorry about that, Dr. Wimbledon. I have no idea about it.
That's all right.
We've got less than 5 minutes left. Let's suppose my listeners have been intrigued and they want to know more about you. How can they find out more about you?
I have a website, which is www.benwitherington.com, and I also have a blog, at which you can get to from the front page of my website. If you look at the upper right-hand corner of the front page of www.benwitherington.com, there is a little square there that says blog. You can click on that and get directly to my blog. I write every single day for the Pathios website, and I'm happy to have anybody who would like to find it.
Okay. And we've got about 3.5 minutes left. So is there any final message you would like to leave for my listeners for it so they can just message about you, about the Christmas season, anything whatsoever?
Sure. I will leave you with two quotes that are some of my favorite Christmas quotes. The first is from George MacDonald, who was one of C.S. Lewis's favorite fantasy writers. He once wrote the following, "We were looking for a king to slay our foes and lift us high. Thou cam'st a little baby thing that made a woman cry. Jesus didn't come to meet our expectations. He came to meet our needs." And the second is a quote from my very favorite metaphysical poet from England named John Donne. He says this, "'Twas much that we were made like God long before," in other words, created in the image of God, "but that God should be made like us much more." Merry Christmas.
Well, Dr. Wivington, I really want to thank you for taking your time. I know we had some difficulties connecting, but it looks like everything got all worked out. I definitely thank you for taking your time to be on the People Water show, and I really hope we'll get to see you back here again sometime.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. Thanks so much, and Merry Christmas to you as well, Nick.
You too. You know, with that, we'll go ahead and be signing off right now because we've only got a couple minutes left. There's not much more I can say, but I really hope you've enjoyed this edition of the Deeper Waters podcast and been blessed by hearing Dr. Wivington speak. I certainly have been. And no, I'm not going to be taking any more calls. I know someone else is calling, and especially after what happened with the last one. For now, I'm Nick Peters of Deeper Waters Podcast, and I'm signing off.